Well, Gunung Padang.
Yes.
I realize that this is an artist's rendition of what it would look like. This is in Indonesia.
Yes,
tell
but
me
it's
what
based,
this is.
It's based on the very solid science and archaeological work.
Why is there a 20,000-year-old pyramid in Indonesia?
That's a very good question. The Great Pyramids of Egypt are 4,500 years old. The Mayan pyramids are less than 2,000 years old. So how did Graham Hancock manage to find a 20,000-year-old pyramid in Indonesia?
20,000-year-old pyramid. Man, it looks like I got my work cut out for me in this episode, don't I? All you guys that kept telling me, man, Potholer, he's the one that you got to go after. Good luck with that one. You know the saying, be careful what you wish for? Today, my friends, you are going to get it. Well, hello and welcome back to the next episode of Dedunking. And for those of you who have been subscribed to me for a while, you know I'm not going to try to defend that 20,000-year-old pyramid. But for Potholer and for anybody watching this that hasn't seen me debunk somebody before, it's important to note that I'm not some like diehard Hancockian where I'm going to hang my hat on everything that he says. I'm back to 30-40% of what he says is accurate at best camp. I understand that he misleads people at times. So, and I don't think that there's some ancient civilization that was flying Ptolemy jets around and landing them on the Bimini Road as an aircraft carrier. So, with that out of the way, it's important to note that I will be conceding several points along the way. I mean, those of you who watched my first video know that I'm not going to be hanging my hat on Gunung Padang or Namadol. I think that both of them, if you were to rate Hancock's evidence on a scale of 1 to 5, 2s to 1s and a halves is where these ones would fall. Not very good evidence at all. Not the kind of thing that I would bring out. But that doesn't change what we're about to see here.
In this video, we'll find the answer to that, and you won't believe how he did it. Well, maybe you will if you're familiar with Hancock's body of work. And please mirror this video because it could very soon get blocked.
Well, thanks for the permission. I'm going to chop it up and comment on it, and it'll probably take me 2 videos to get up one of yours, but I hope you don't mind. For those of you who've been watching me for a while, this is another important thing to point out. I am not going to omit a single frame of his video from this. It's going to be point A to point B. I'm going to respond to each individual section that has a noteworthy point to respond to, and I want to let his entire arguments play out as they are.
If you're a Graham Hancock fan and you think everyone else should open their minds enough to share his belief, here's a challenge. Will you open your mind enough to watch this video and see what Hancock missed and fabricated in his new Netflix series, Ancient Apocalypse? Can't hurt, can it?
And that same challenge goes out to you Potholer 54 fans out there too. You know, what's it going to hurt you to watch this and see how your boy plays the game, right? It's a little critique, no big deal. And one more thing worth pointing out here. You know that critiquing Graham Hancock is one of the most competitive areas in that entire archaeological, historical, YouTube educational sphere. It's a great place that people go to farm for views. It's a great jumping off point for new channels. And it's the kind of thing that you have to wonder how someone, when 200 different people have reviewed Ancient Apocalypse in episode 1, how is it that Potholers is the one that keeps getting brought around? They're all using the same peer-reviewed evidence to hit Hancock. So how is it that Potholers got to the top? Well, everybody's got all their different shtick, right? Like Milo from Any Minute Man, his shtick is like, he's going to make it fun, he's going to make it snarky, he's going to laugh, he's going to throw some of that young guy energy. That's my preferred method, but I have old guy energy, so like, I don't know, I have to drink like 4 cups of coffee and jump up and down a bunch before I can even try to do that. But then you got like Stefan Milo, he's got his method of kind of the dry British humor, and he's very well researched and laid out very cleanly, so it's easy to understand. You got guys like Dr. Miano, where when he goes after Hancock, it almost makes you feel like stupid for having believed anything that Hancock said to begin with. And then you got guys like Potholer that when he's done, there's like just a crater where Hancock once stood. There's nothing left. What argument? What Graham Hancock? There's what? It's gone. How does he do that? I'm going to show you.
There used to be a popular program in the UK called Time Team with actor Tony Robinson, playing the non-scientist, reporting on various archaeological digs around Britain. In one program, they were investigating a geophysical anomaly believed to be an old Roman villa. But the bits of pottery and brick they dug up kept pointing to a medieval monastery instead. "That's not what we want to find," said a disappointed Tony. Professor Mick Aston, who supervised the digs, had to patiently explain how archaeology works. "What we want to find as archaeologists," he said, "is the answer to whatever was here. And if it was a medieval monastery, then we find what we find." And that's the difference between a professional scientist and an enthusiastic amateur. When it comes to answering questions about history, archaeologists want to find whatever is actually there. Because each piece of evidence, each discovery, however dull or disappointing it may be, fills in another piece of our jigsaw puzzle that starts to give a complete and accurate history of our species.
And right off the bat here, we get this subtle trickery. He's comparing the hard data of what's dug up out of the ground with the soft side of archaeology, which is the interpretation part, where they build a framework out of all the different data they get, and then they get an idea in their head of this is how things went together, and then they make things fit that framework. That interpretation aspect of it is quite a bit different than what you dig out of the ground. And I think anybody would understand that. Even Hancock would be like, well, yeah, if that's an arrowhead, that's an arrowhead. If this was a piece of a pottery shard that's from a fucking Roman site, it's from a Roman site. If it's not, it's not. The difference is the framework and how Hancock interprets it versus how archaeologists interpret it. But that's the soft part of the science, so he can't really say that and portray Hancock as an idiot. His whole stick, in order to nuke Hancock, is to just keep knocking him down a peg, keep knocking him down a peg, keep knocking him down a peg, so that when that boot lands, it is boom. But this is the first example of it. It's just going to keep going.
The Quest for Lost Civilizations has been a book and movie favorite for years. In the 1970s, Eric von Daniken promoted the idea that aliens had come to Earth to teach ancient people how to build things. Once that fad had passed, Graham Hancock swiped von Daniken's book titles and the aliens became emissaries from a lost civilization wiped out about 12,000 years ago. Who taught ancient people how to build things?
One of the things he does is string these clips together very quickly, so you don't have a lot of time to digest all of these knocking down Hancock a peg topics. You just kind of look at it and you're like, okay, that makes sense, and then you go to the next one. For example, right here, now we just jump straight into the pedigree of Hancock's ideas. Oh, they came from ancient aliens, and they came from ancient apocalypse and all, or they came from Atlantis and all these other weird things from 100-some-odd years ago. Thankfully, he didn't get into playing the old ism card like everybody else likes to, like a lot of other people do anyway. But all of that's a nothing burger. And if you stop and think about it for a second, if you're a person that understands science, knows the history of this stuff, you should probably know that that pedigree argument is crap. What's the pedigree of chemistry? Alchemy? So, and like he says, we'll just switch the books from the title from one to another. So we just switch the symbol from a freaking astrological sign to a chemical sign and an atomic weight. And now all of a sudden it's science. I mean, see how easy it is to do that? Oh, speaking of astrology, where did astronomy come from? Oh, well, I guess astronomy is just a bunch of bogus crap, isn't it? No, of course not. And archaeology, what was that, not rooted in antiquities, theft, and selling? Come on. The pedigree argument's crap. He actually would probably know it's crap. But by stringing them together really quickly, you're like, well, oh, man, they got bad pedigree. That's too bad.
The last thing we want to believe, it seems, is that our ancestors were smart enough to learn for themselves how to build these things over a long period of time. But if outside help is always needed, I wonder how Hancock's imaginary civilization figured it all out on their own.
And subtly, he makes the same argument that somebody made as a joke when my channel first started getting popular as on a comment was pyramids are just the easiest way of stacking rocks. But here he is actually making this argument. And it's like, dude, that is not where any of us are coming from. None of us think that there's no way they could have learned to build a pyramid on their own. Why didn't you show what came after those pyramids? Because you're trying to show this nice, steady technological climb. Well, why don't we look at the pyramids that came right after the last pyramid at Giza was built? Let's take some... Well, that doesn't fit with your timeline very good. Now we're talking about a pile of rocks, aren't we? Wow, it's almost like... more. Oh, man. It's almost like technology regressed or the skills fell backwards or something like that. And no, I'm not saying they use fucking power plants or some bullshit to build them with. Don't mistake me for saying it's all crazy. I'm saying they had some very talented people working with those great pyramids at Giza. Those three big boys had some very talented, very skilled people working on them compared to every other pyramid in the area. And there's a lot of other enigmas about it. I've talked about it some before. Point is that he's obfuscating all that. We're just going to pretend none of that exists. LOL rocks.
I spent decades searching for proof of this lost civilization.
And he's still searching, because after 30 years of touring the world, Hancock still hasn't discovered a single town, or a burial site, or a boat, no writing, not even a garbage dump.
And for those of you who've been subscribed to me for a while, you know exactly what I'm going to say here, but you didn't know that I had turned it into a sing-along.
Sea peoples, where do they go? Only Atlanteans know a sea peoples.
Pretty bitchin', huh? But honestly, I understand that we have more contemporary accounts from the Sea Peoples and that all of the fingerprints of the gods stuff is myth passed through generations. I get that. But he didn't say anything about that. He's not talking about the difference between the reports and the accounts. He's talking about these hard data points that if he swung that same hammer that he's swinging to knock the Atlanteans right out of academia, he would be knocking those Sea Peoples out of academia too. So This is the kind of argument that I find kind of a nothing burger, because they don't apply this across the board. If that aforementioned framework that I talked about, if their framework accounts for those peoples, those hypothetical peoples that they don't have one single button for, oh, they'll shove them right in there. But if it doesn't, well, they're not getting shoved in.
Hancock's explanation is that this civilization existed somewhere he doesn't go, like...
One of them is the Amazon. Another is the Sahara Desert. And then under the continental shelves.
And let's not forget buried under the ice of Antarctica, which he proposed in his book, Fingerprints of the Gods.
And see, here we have another cheap shot without actually putting it into context at all. Sure, that's what he said in Fingerprints of the Gods, because he was hanging his hat on Earth crust displacement theory, which at the time was already an outdated idea, but it is a hypothetical model for the way that the Earth's crust can shift around the core, and I don't subscribe to it by any means, but Einstein did, so it's not like it's mouth breather stuff, and this was a serious hypothetical hypothesis. It was a contender for the current model back in the 50s. So it's not, this isn't like some mouth breather, ha ha ha, he thought Antarctica was warm and blah ha ha. But we all know that Antarctica has been covered with ice for millions of years. So by just, you know, making that out, he makes Hancock go a little further down, because that boot's getting ready to land and he needs to have him all the way down. But we're not there yet. He's got a few more really degrading things to do that are...
But the one thing we know about this imaginary civilization is that they were supposedly experts at building huge pyramids. But despite commercial and private planes flying all over these remote places, plus the advent of Google Earth, no one spotted a single one. Even Hancock hasn't bothered to spend some of the millions he made selling books and TV programs to hire a private plane and look for his lost civilization. The only place on Earth where we know for sure this pyramid-building civilization did exist is in Hancock's head, because he'll be the first one to tell you that this isn't a fact, it's his belief. Which is fine. Where he comes into conflict with reality is where he claims he's found mysteries that support his belief.
But just a minute ago I showed you what a bunch of pyramids that were built in Egypt like 4,000 years ago look like today. Now, if Hancock's hypothesis about some horrible global catastrophe is accurate, how many pyramids are going to make it after 12,000 years? I mean, this is just stupid. This is ridiculous. Anybody with the brain on their shoulders can look at that claim and be like, well, that's not really a very valid point against him, is it? What are we going to have? Look at Gnong Penang. Hancock tries to call that a pyramid because of how it was built up at one time. So even if he embellishes the crap out of it, look at what's left of it. And how many years old is it? Man, see, this is what I mean. And then you're going to say that there's no mysteries. Yeah. Okay, Sure, there's nothing that we haven't explained from that stuff. I'm sure that you can totally explain why that there's no funerary inscriptions inside of the Great Pyramid. It's not a mastaba, guys. I don't even want to talk about that. Don't go there.
Hancock's ideas have been laid out in numerous books and TV shows, and now a Netflix series, thanks to whoever posted the message alerting me to it. I had intended to go through the whole series and see if I could spot any errors, but no kidding, by the time I got to the end of just the first episode, I found so many fabrications, omissions, and misrepresentations that I already had enough to fill this entire video, which turns out to be the longest I've ever made.
Yeah, this is going to be a really long video for me too, and I had to cut yours in half to even make this work, but are we going to see any fabrications or misrepresentations or omissions coming from your side of the table? Because that would be really embarrassing. Because, see, one of you has a veneer of academic authority, you see, and the other one is a woo peddler, right? You know you need to look up Hancock's claims, but what about yours? Nobody thinks they should, but here we are about to find out why they actually need to.
Before we start, you need to understand that as well as copying von Daniken's book titles, Hancock also follows von Daniken's tried and tested modus operandi for leading an unskeptical audience, as we'll see throughout. And rule number one is start by painting professional archaeologists as bumbling, dogmatic, and baffled by whatever they find.
Of course. This idea is upsetting to the so-called experts. The extremely defensive, arrogant, and patronizing attitude of mainstream academia, the initial evidence has utterly confounded mainstream archaeologists.
Then step in as a persecuted visionary who dares to challenge them with innovative new ideas.
And while, yes, I will be the first to concede that Hancock frequently says things that are misleading and that he has, like, zero respect for the archaeological community, I will be the first to concede that. I will point out here that this is a little bit on the hypocritical side from what we're about to see. You're starting off by just demonizing Hancock and complaining about him demonizing archaeologists. It's like, yeah, you guys are playing from the same damn playbook, man. Why don't you just talk about the facts and the evidence that he brings to the table? Now you're going to spend all this time just talking about how terrible he is, how terrible his ideas are, how terrible all of this is, but you haven't even addressed a single thing really yet, have you? This is all knocking him down.
The series kicks off at a megalithic site in Indonesia called Gunung Padang, and within a few minutes, Hancock is already softening up his audience with rule number one, portray archaeologists as a bunch of incompetents who wouldn't know a significant site if they tripped over it.
For a long while, archaeologists thought it was just another hill in the jungle. But there was a problem with that view.
Yes, there was a problem with that view. Hancock made it up. And there's no better evidence for that than Hancock himself. In a speech posted in 2018, Hancock's claim was qualified.
For a very long time, it was thought to be just a natural hill.
That's all.
With an interesting megalithic site on top of it.
Ah, yes, just an ordinary hill with a megalithic site on top of it. And in an earlier interview posted in 2016, he said this.
For a very long time, people believed that it was just a natural hill.
With?
With an old, but not extremely old, megalithic site on top of it.
So clearly Hancock knew that his claim in the Netflix film that archaeologists thought this was just another hill was nonsense. He made this up simply because it made archaeologists look stupid and it made him look smart.
Now, this is a complete misrepresentation. Hancock is saying that it's not a natural hill. His position is that it was like man-made pyramid-y hill, right? I don't agree with that position, but you should at least represent it properly if you're going to knock it down, and that's not what he's doing. He's making it seem like Hancock is just bullshitting his audience, saying that, oh, you know, nobody even knew anything about it, but I actually knew that there was stuff up there. I'm just going to pretend that nobody else knew that there was stuff. It's very disingenuous. But here, I'll play a clip from the episode so you can see that I'm not lying.
What Dr. Hillman started to realize as he put together all his data was that Gunung Padang is much more than just a hill. This is the ancient site of Gunung Padang.
hey, I can point a phone at a TV too. Look at that. But seriously, this shows that Hancock's not talking about it being some natural hill. That's what his thing is that for a long time people thought it was a natural hill, and he thinks that that wasn't the case. So that's what he's talking about here, and Potholer is very aware of that. There's no way he didn't get that.
And there's no excuse for this fabrication either.
At first sight, this open terrace could be mistaken for a natural formation of volcanic rock, which is why archaeologists were so slow to investigate it.
But archaeologists didn't mistake it for a natural formation, as Hancock well knows. And he also knows they weren't slow to investigate it. Again, we have to go back to other statements Hancock made to show he knew that very well.
It's a megalithic site that's been in plain view and was in fact first inspected by archaeologists as early as 1914.
Yes, a megalithic site in plain view, not mistaken for a natural formation, and investigated as far back as 1914 when a Dutch archaeologist wrote a report about it. The site was forgotten about during the turmoil of World War II and the bitter war that ended Dutch colonial rule. But when three farmers rediscovered it in 1979, Indonesian archaeologists immediately investigated. Indonesia's National Research Centre of Archaeology issued a report on Gunung Padang in 1985. At that time, Hancock was writing a book about the AIDS epidemic. After the National Research Centre of Archaeology came studies and investigations by archaeologists from Indonesia's Directorate of Antiquities, the National Archaeological Research and Development Institute, and the Bandung Archaeological Centre. So ironically, archaeologists took an interest in the site long before Hancock did.
Now this section needs broken down pretty good, so I want you to pay attention here. Watch how the very first thing that he does is just kind of bypass the fact that Hancock said at first glance. So you listen to Hancock real quick.
At first sight, this open terrace could be mistaken for a natural formation of volcanic rock. At first sight.
So at first glance, it doesn't look like an archaeological site, is what Hancock is saying. And while he frequently is unfair to archaeologists, as I've said many times in the past, this time he's being really fair to them. Yes, they didn't investigate it for a very long time, but he's tricking you with this. Notice he gives you all this information, and at the very end, what does he say? Oh, ironically, that these guys, archaeologists, were interested in this before Hancock was. Well, that was never Hancock's claim, not at all, but that's a nice way to tie a bow in it, I guess. But where Hancock's claim is that it wasn't investigated for a long time. Typical Hancock, it's a vague term. But when you think of archaeology, what do you think of? What years do you think of when you think of the early days of archaeology? Like the early, early days, like the beginnings of actual archaeology as a science, not antiquity dealing. Late 1800s, early 1900s, right then when they said that they first excavated it in 1914? Yeah, but see, back in 1790s, the Dutch started an archaeological foundation down there in Java. And in the 18-teens, they went batshit crazy, looting temples and looking for megalithic sites. There's a bunch of Buddha heads that are missing down there still because they got sold to Europeans and stuff, chopped off of the freaking statues and whatnot. And in that 100 years' time of this crazy craze to tear up all of those sites all across Java, nobody noticed. Not one person decided to excavate Gunung Padang. Not one person excavated there over the course of that 100+ years of craziness. So yes, for a very long time, this site was bypassed. But he doesn't want you to look back at the history of that, so he just gish gallops with a bunch of information that is irrelevant. Hancock doesn't care. When the 70s, 80s, 90s, has nothing to do with his claims. Who cares about what happened with Gunung Padang in 1985? It doesn't matter. Does it matter that Hancock was writing a book about the AIDS epidemic? No, it doesn't. But it knocks him down a peg. And he's lying to do it. Yes, there was a 100-year period where Gunung Padang went undiscovered because at first glance, it doesn't look like an archaeological site.
If you want to know what archaeologists really think, ask them. Don't get a summary of their investigations and conclusions from the guy whose success depends on discrediting them. They conclude that evidence shows Gunung Padang is an old, extinct volcano into which at least 5 terraces have been cut near the top, one of which has a retaining wall. Rough enclosures and pavements have been laid out, as well as stairs up to the site, using readily available volcanic columns as building material. And it was built around 2,500 years ago. These hexagonal columns form when molten lava comes out of the volcano, cools quickly, shrinks, and creates hexagonal cracks. Even Hancock accepts that. When they weather, they collapse, forming loosely scattered columnar joints. You can see loosely scattered columnar joints not only at Gunung Padang, but also other sites like Detonata Goala in Romania. But unlike Gunung Padang, they haven't been arranged in patterns and no terraces have been cut. There are dozens of megalithic sites in Indonesia, but Gunung Padang is the largest.
And so we get a little lesson in columnar basalt, even though Hancock laid it out, because you can't, you know, you can't say that he actually knew what it is. You just have to say that he accepts it, kind of like Hancock would say archaeologists accept that this site's dated to, and he's, even Hancock accepts. It's strange how you see kind of the same word games going on back and forth between these two people that have total disdain for each other. But besides that, look at how Gunung Padang is the largest megalithic site on Java, and it went undiscovered during 100 years of madness. It has a stairway leading up to the damn thing. It's got 5 terraces. Does that sound like a natural hill to you? It's not a pyramid, but that's not really a natural hill like he was hammering on about earlier. This is all just a bunch of little character assassination things to make Hancock look like a mouth breather. Because he's about to start, there's a lot of the Gunung Padang stuff that actually is wrong, and when he starts kicking him there, those kicks will land a lot better and a lot more flashy if Hancock already looks like he's laying there on the ground curled up sucking his thumb.
After painting a picture of archaeologists as a bunch of naysaying incompetents, Hancock interviews a geologist called Danny Natawijaja, who, for the purposes of his program, represents the complete opposite.
Dr. Danny Hillman Natawijaja studied at Caltech, but now works for Indonesia's Geotechnology Research Center.
So, a professional, sober, competent geologist.
Absolutely. Danny comes at this as a scientist. His interest is data. Which is,
yeah, good. Someone who's completely impartial and only interested in the science and what his scientific equipment tells him.
They did ground-penetrating radar, seismic tomography, electrical resistivity.
All right, Graham, lots and lots of real and objective science. We get the point. There had been an archaeological team excavating the site since 2011. Then in 2013, Natawijaja independently started his own investigation using drills and ground-penetrating radar. Hancock describes what happened next.
An extraordinary new possibility began to force itself on the researchers, that they might be confronted by the work of a civilization lost to history.
But of course, this is a Hancock film, so things are not always as straightforward as the story we're being told. Natawijaja is indeed a geologist, a renowned seismologist, very competent in his own field, and here's one of his books. But he's also been a long-time proponent of the idea that Indonesia is the site of Atlantis. Yes, you heard that right. He's not only promoted the idea in print, he explained it to Graham Hancock in previous interviews as far back as 2014. So the idea of an ancient civilization was hardly forced on Natawijaja. He'd already reached that conclusion long before he started his 2013 investigation. But none of that was mentioned in the Netflix program.
And I don't really have much snarky to say here. Yeah, that was pretty misleading of him to not mention the fact that this guy's already on board with that stuff. Now, it is a fact that when it comes to those frameworks like I was talking about earlier, Natawijaja is going to be hanging his stuff on a different framework than mainstream archaeologists. And that's really where the contention between this whole thing is going to be, right? Is that he's looking to shoehorn in to Atlantis being there on Java, apparently. So that's the difference there. But what's really important to pay attention to and to keep in mind going forward is that this guy works for the Javanese government, and he is an Atlantis hunter. Put a pin in that.
Natawijaja never published his findings, so all we can go on is a poster he showed at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union in 2018. It shows that this supposed pyramid is indeed an extinct volcano, a natural hill with terraces cut near the top, just as archaeologists had always said. There's no way for Hancock to get around this embarrassing discovery, unless, of course, he changes the definition of a pyramid, which, of course, he does.
There's a question of definitions here. How do we define a pyramid? But if we define it as a structure that rises in a series of terraces to a summit, that's what we're looking at.
Well, no, I don't define a pyramid as a series of terraces to a summit in a natural hill. Otherwise, there are pyramids all over East Asia, and other parts of Indonesia come to that.
Now, again, I don't have a whole lot of snark to say to that. Yeah, that unpublished work, as I mentioned in my first video, that's crap. You can't really parade that kind of stuff around and act like it's published, because that's crap. Well, it's about as bad as pretending published papers aren't published, isn't it? Anyway, it is important, once again, to point something out here, though. You notice that top of that poster that Dr. Natty Wajaja had there? The top little yellow section there, you can check that out right there, it says something about that pyramid, or that, excuse me, that pyramid. It says something about that site being heavily messed with by humans over a long period of time, like a man-made type of site, right? So if that is the assertion that Natty Wajaja has, and that is the assertion that Hancock has, earlier, when he was taking Hancock slightly out of context, when Hancock is saying this, the archaeologist thought this was a natural hill. No, it's not just an ordinary hill. He knew what Hancock meant. It wasn't about the site on top. It was about it being a man-made hill. But Potholer had to make sure that he didn't represent that right, because these blows that he's making now, when you watch the video, all just those things all stitched together really quick. At this point, man, you're just like, holy shit, Hancock just looks stupid as hell. Because now we're at the part where, yeah, Hancock's wrong here, man. You don't parade out non-peer-reviewed work and pretend it's peer-reviewed. That's bullshit.
Hancock not only redefines the pyramid, but he also scales back his illustrations. Just a few years ago, this was what his pyramid supposedly looked like, based on
the very solid science and archaeological work.
But in the Netflix film, it's been scaled back. Even with artistic embellishments and a bit of imagination added, it's clearly a natural hill with a megalithic site on top.
And well, we got two things to point out here really quick. Number one, for a scientist to complain about someone else changing their position, presumably because they got new information. The other one would be, why don't we look at the other image that he showed in that same link that you keep showing, that nice fancy green with all the waterfalls and shit. There was another image that was shown in that exact same presentation, the link that you provided. Why don't we click on that link and see what we got there?
And these core drills were bringing up worked stone and organic material that could be dated. Because according to the...
Oh, well, you look at that. That looks a whole lot closer to that. I wonder why Potholer chose not to show that image instead of the other one. Starting to see a pattern here?
Even the archaeologist Hancock interviews Ali Akbar, who, by the way, also wants to believe that Indonesia is an ancient civilization, confirms that what we see on the hill, all of this, is a megalithic site about 2,500 years old.
Well, now, isn't that interesting? We've got two Atlantis hunting scientists that are running around down there in Indonesia. I wonder what's up with that. I bet you he looked into this too, because that's a little anomalous. And I mentioned this in passing in my first video, but I'm going to read briefly here. I think this is an important peer-reviewed published paper to take a look at. Indonesia's own pyramid, the imagined past and nationalism of Gunung Padang. Abstract, a narrative commonly found within the discourse of nationalist archaeology, is a polemic ideology at the expense of empiricism. There are many examples of the manipulation of archaeological data in the service of the state's nationalist or imperialist ideology, and such efforts produce narratives in which archaeology is treated inherently apolitical. This paper explores the interactions between and within multiple stakeholders, the state, archaeologists, and the media, and their roles in the construction
destruction of national myths and the consequences for local populations. It highlights a recent controversy surrounding the reinterpretation of the megalithic site of Gunung Padang in western Java, Indonesia. Now we scroll down a little bit further and we see, by examining the archaeological research that took place at the site of Gunung Padang in West Java between 2011 and 2014, the authors investigate how multiple and competing interpretations of nationalisms are contended through scientific archaeological discourse. Indonesia provides an interesting case to observe how nationalism and archaeology relate to each other. When Hancock's number one criticism of the archaeological community is they are fallible, they frequently lean against things and lean on it so hard that they don't really pay attention to what else is going on. Sometimes they do things that are manipulative and unscrupulous. Well, yes. Here's a perfect example. It's happening in Java right now. And he probably figured this out, but you can't really go say that, because then every time Hancock challenges archaeology, you have to look at the country you're in, like we're going to have to when we go down to Malta. You have to look at the country that you're in and see, is tourism affecting it? Is nationalism affecting it? And in the case of Java, the answer is yes. So when that happens, all of a sudden, you have a problem with the science surrounding that stuff. Hancock uses that as an arguing point all the time. So Potholer will definitely not acknowledge that as part of reality.
And he tells Hancock that. So now comes the job of making the audience believe there must be something inside the hill, and watch carefully how he does it. First, we hear Dr. Akbar explain that just below the surface, his team uncovered artifacts dating back to around 7,200 years ago. Suggesting that humans had visited the site that far back. And Hancock initially reports this correctly.
They quickly found evidence that humans had been present in what's called a cultural layer.
That's right, evidence that humans had been present. Hardly surprising in an area where hunter-gatherers would have roamed 7,000 years ago and no doubt occasionally camped on top of the hill. But then Hancock very subtly switches the dates. He turns the humans who were here 7,200 years ago into the builders of a site that he's just been told is about 2,500 years ago.
An old, but not extremely old, megalithic site.
And the reason no one notices the switch is because he slips it into a question.
7,000 years ago, far from being builders on such an epic scale, there's no evidence that the people of this region were anything other than simple hunter-gatherers. What could have motivated them to make the immense effort of bringing all these blocks here?
The audience is so busy pondering the question, they don't notice that Hancock has just introduced not one, but two fallacies into the question. The first is that all the blocks were brought here. The second is that it was done 7,000 years ago. I wish I could say that Hancock is a genius at this kind of manipulation, but in fact it's a very old technique. Journalists and salesmen use it all the time. So do advertisers.
Now, this was the clip that told me this wasn't a mistake on Potholer's part. The way he crafted these arguments, the way he missed certain things, none of this was by mistake. He didn't just magically come up with this way to just nuke Hancock. This was very deliberate. Look at the way he's able to call out this sneaky little tricky thing. And nobody else I responded to so far pulled that one out, but he did. And why? Because he's better at it than Hancock is. He's good at it. He's doing it right here. Look at how he's crafted this entire argument to trick you into thinking that every single thing that Hancock says is just dumb as hell. It's kind of funny, except for that scientific educational YouTube veneer of authority. This is the kind of shit that really challenges it, and it really just, it makes it easy for anybody to come in and say anything when people can demonstrate that people like you are full of shit.
They don't advertise UK lottery tickets by giving you important and relevant information, like the fact that only about half the money people spend on lottery tickets actually gets returned as prizes, or the fact that your chance of winning the jackpot is around 1 in 45 million. They have to ignore inconvenient facts and instead feed your imagination. And the best way to do that is to ask, what would you do if you won? And even the implicit "if you won" is either subdued or completely omitted, because we have to turn this improbability into something people believe could be real.
What would I do if I won Lotto? I'd play 18 holes at Glen Eagles.
I'd really love to see the Northern Lights.
If I won Lotto, I'd get myself a house with my own pool.
Lotto, what would you do?
And here I can't help but think that he's like just laughing and how easily he can lead people by the nose here. Listen to the sentence that he says, and then listen to the lady that talked about what she would do if she won the lottery.
And even the implicit "if you won" is either subdued or completely omitted.
If I won Lotto, I'd get myself a house with my own pool.
Does the beginning of a sentence sound subdued to you? Did that sound subdued to you or absent? No, but he could have picked any clips he wanted. He picked that one. Why did he pick that one? Because, I swear to God, because he knows. And he's just kind of laughing at this point, rubbing it in, going, man, look at these guys. I didn't fucking follow anything.
Having given this impression that all these stones were physically carried to the site, Hancock then reinforces it.
Every one of these blocks, up to 50,000 of them, and each weighing up to a third of a ton, were carried up this hill.
Even the experts Hancock spoke to don't make that claim. Again, the columns are perfectly natural, and they're found scattered naturally at Gunung Padang, just as they are at Detonata Gualla. And also here at the Devil's Post Pile in California. They're the result of cooling joints, weathering and collapsing. According to a paper published by the University of Geneva, some of the stones have been transported, and they were used for the stairway. They were brought from 300 metres away from the Sakuta River, and others a little further down the valley. Not an impossible feat, even for hunter-gatherers, let alone Iron Age people from 500 BC.
I don't think the question of how they moved them is that big of a deal. It's pretty obvious that, like, up until you get into like the 2-ton range, that most of these things can be moved fairly easily. It is, once again, concession time. Hancock should not misrepresent the way that these blocks were moved or not moved, as the case may be.
There are dozens of examples of monuments being built around that time, and even older, not just in Indonesia, but all over Southeast Asia. Sometimes we know exactly how they were moved, because the practice continued until recently. Sometimes we know how they could have been moved. All it takes is organization, manpower, a few simple tools, and lots of rope. So there's really no mystery in how people from 2,500 years ago could have rearranged columnar joints they found naturally scattered on top of Gunung Padang. And that's the problem for Hancock, because his books and his films depend on a mystery that he steps in to solve. So he has to manufacture one.
And when Potholer knows that about half the people watching this or more won't even have watched Ancient Apocalypse, he can get away with crap like that. But that's not at all what Hancock's position is on it. He doesn't wonder how they moved all these blocks that he misrepresented.
What could have motivated them to make the immense effort of bringing all these blocks here?
Oh, wow. Look at that. His mystery is why. So the fact that most people that watch the debunking videos haven't actually watched Ancient Apocalypse works out in Potholer's favor here, because he can just say whatever the hell he wants and you'll probably just buy it. Again, got you by the nose and leading you around. And he doesn't have to do this in order to debunk Hancock, but he sure as hell does in order to get everybody recommending him to somebody like me. He sure as hell does in order to be near the top of that very competitive pile of historians and archaeologists, and in this case a geologist, trying to vie for who's the debunker king of all debunkers. And I'm sorry to say it, but for as many people have said this guy was the badass, I found him the most intellectually dishonest and with the most falsehoods out of everybody that I've done so far. Even Emperor Tiger Star's numerous mistakes were not nearly as bad as this. This guy made as many mistakes, and I believe that every single one of them was intentional. Good times. Anyway, thank you very much for watching this far. Almost to 1,000 subscribers. About to make that their response video to all of your comments and stuff. That'll be a big old long one of me sitting there babbling and Hopefully that's enjoyable and doesn't just kill my channel the day that I make it, but what do you do? Thanks again for watching this far. I really appreciate all the support. Don't forget to click the buttons down below, the likes and the subscribe, and this is the bell so you get the thing, and I've got social media links too, and yeah. Anyway, have a great night.
We'll take this rebel, and we will, as before, we will cut it right here.
Yeah.
And now you're going to see this happen right in front of you here, Rebel. This is the part that's mind-blowing. Take the end of that in your left hand. Now, see those two ends right there?
Yeah.
That's... Sprinkle the wiffle dust over it. Sprinkle it over the... Just slowly. And it'll heal right there in front of you. Look at that. All of that.